Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osman here on KLBB Club 1220 for the next hour with Tom Hsu running the audio lab next
Why,
door.
Hello, sir.
Hello. I found a video clip of Tom Hsu on the internet.
Oh, no.
And because it's St. Patrick's Day, I want to just play a quick little audio bite just to get the mood of the show going here. We are St. Patrick's Eve.
So I'm really concerned, genuinely concerned.
I just want to get everyone engaged in the show right away today.
To alcohol, the cause of and solution to all of life's problems.
It is St. Patrick's Eve, and there I found Tom St. Patrick's Day from last year, downtown Minneapolis, on top of several wooden beer barrels.
Thanks to all of that beer, my voice dropped several octaves and became much more funny.
Yeah, it was funny. That's a Simpsons audio bite, one of the best Simpson quotes of all time.
I actually say that pretty regularly, pretty often.
And if you don't watch The Simpsons, which is unfortunate, but Homer Simpson is on top of a pile of beer barrels, and this is the old-fashioned wood beer barrels. Apparently in the Springfield world, they have wood beer barrels.
That's how it works.
But it is St. Patrick's Day Eve, and it is a time where, depending on your political stripe, or everyone becomes Irish and everyone causes trouble down in our downtown St. Paul, Minneapolis. In 1982, which is 32 years ago, and actually March 15th, 1982, there was concern that there might be some hooligans downtown. There might be some spirits and minerals being consumed downtown. I got a little story here. Let's take a flashback here and listen to our friend Stan Turner give us the info on what's going to happen.
It is a source of pride for St. Paul, but also a cause for concern. The city's St. Patrick's Day parade is the third largest in the country, with about 100,000 revelers marching or watching or doing a little bit of both. Police are always on hand to make sure those festivities don't get too far out of hand, but there'll be fewer police at this year's march on Wednesday. That's because of budget cuts. But our Libby Snymer reports the city is planning to spend $14,000 on police overtime as they prepare for the onslaught of the green.
St. Patrick's Day is more than a celebration for the Irish. It is a rite of spring, and members of all ethnic groups like to indulge and sometimes overindulge. This year, St. Paul police will have 22 fewer patrolmen on duty for the parade, but they say this won't make it difficult to control the crowds.
Because we've had some experience with it now, we have a pretty good idea where we do have our problems. And by condensing the officers into that area, I think we can probably handle it with less officers.
Today, there were also preparations for St. Paddy's Day in some of St. Paul's bars. They are expecting a bonanza. This bar will be open for business at 8 a.m. on St. Patrick's Day, and the management expects 5,000 people to come through here before it closes at 1 in the morning.
I do about 3 weeks of business in one day.
Earning that extra money does take a lot of hard work.
Really, I figure the waitresses should really wear the shoulder pads and stuff like that, for like the hockey players. That way we can get through and everything else. But we have a very fun time.
Not all Irish people think St. Patrick's Day is just a fun time. Many believe the celebration of drinking projects a negative image of the Irish.
Drunkenness, rowdyism.
Jim Kennedy represents the oldest organized Irish group in St. Paul.
This is not the true Irishman. Sure, we enjoy a drink as much as anyone else does, but it does not project the image of the hard-working Irishman that came over here and settled this country.
73-year-old Bob Gallivan doesn't agree. True, he does own a bar. He founded it at another location 50 years ago, St. Patrick's Day. He is also a founding member of the St. Patrick Society.
Do you find that it gives a bad name to Irishmen?
Geez, it never bothered me any.
You're taking fun.
Why would it give an Irishman a bad name?
I think it's the amateur Irish that probably give him a bad name. You know, the amateur Irish doesn't want to be Irish just on one day. The true Irishman doesn't really get out of hand on St. Patrick's Day.
This year, organizers of the parade are presenting it as a family-oriented event. Because of that, some Irish groups that boycotted the festivities in past years will be participating on Wednesday. Libby Znaimer, Channel 5 Eyewitness News in St. Paul.
We have some good news for drivers irritated.
Well, there you go. Are you amateur Irish or are you...
You know,
like,
I am
Irish?
Neither. I don't condense my drinking into a single day. And I was speaking with Jeff Peterson on the Super Saver Show earlier this week. He got to have a conversation with a pretty prominent bar owner downtown of an Irish pub, and he was just absolutely shocked, totally taken aback when he came to America and was around for his first St. Patrick's Day, because where he grew up in Ireland, it's a feast day for a saint. He said you spent the entire day in church. You did nothing of debauchery, no drinking. It was a celebration of a sacred person.
Leave it to Americans to find any sacred holiday, to find a way to commercialize it. And
you know, I'm even curious about that, because I got to spend a St. Patrick's Day over in Tokyo. And everybody...
This is when you were the morning guy in Tokyo, right? When you were doing mornings and...
Darn right.
Okay, right.
And it was full of Australians were out there. For the majority of it, a lot of the people who were white were going crazy, and they didn't have to be American to do it.
No, I think I think that the tents are up, the green is coming out. It's the lucky marathon was on today. People are posting pictures to our various social media sites. And I was looking for some audio of like a peanut special from St. Patrick's Day.
A
peanut special. They had one for Arbor Day. They had one for 4th of July. Do we discover the true meaning of St. Patrick's Day? People try to question us. You know, Christmas time comes around. We're too commercial. Let's figure out the true meaning of Christmas. You don't hear anyone coming up saying, wait a second, this is not the true meaning of St. Patrick's Day.
Well, I guess if you search for the true meaning of Christmas, you find family and good cheer. You can't find the true meaning of St. Patrick's Day without becoming super religious. And that just doesn't work as well for a TV special.
It's a very interesting juxtaposition between the ultra, or the very religious people that take this very sacredly, and those that have found a way to make St. Patrick's Day, you know, based on a saint, the feast day in Ireland, which is a Christian holiday, to a day to go to a heated tent, and, you know, you have some spirits prior to lunch, and then after lunch, watch a parade, and then take a free ride on Metro Transit back home.
Oh, I am curious how the Metro Transit's going to work out this year.
You know, I've occasionally taken that trip from Minneapolis-St. Paul on Metro Transit on Highway 94 on like a Thursday afternoon, and people are celebrating St. Patrick's Day all year round, apparently downtown Minneapolis. So I've ridden on them with the longest limos in town. I'm curious to see what those limos will be like late on Monday night.
I'm thinking Tuesday morning.
Or Tuesday morning. Let's take a break. We'll go to Rick Shepik. He might have some... He might bring the St. Patrick's Day show into a little bit more intellectual direction here. He has a couple books out I want to talk about, and we'll be right back on Flashback Twin Cities here on KLBB Club 1220. Flashback Twin Cities. Tom Osmond here with my guest, Rick Shepik. Rick, welcome to Flashback Twin Cities, your first time on Flashback Twin Cities.
It is. Thank you, Tom.
We were just talking about Rick grew up in Duluth, and I was asking if he had family still in Duluth. We didn't have an ice palace this year, but Duluth is an ice palace, right? So you actually have to go out and chip your family away before...
That's pretty much true, right?
Summer comes.
Yeah. Most of my family is still living up there. My mom, my brother, sister, cousins. and nephews, nieces. My wife's parents live in Hermantown. That's the warm part of Duluth.
Sure, right, yeah. And you had a big ambition. You wanted to live somewhere much more tropical, so you came to Minneapolis-St. Paul.
I tell people that I moved south for the warmth here. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I feel like you made a slight error.
Well, I didn't get far enough south. I'm still working on it, though.
The best part is you can always look at our temperature here and say, hey, at least I'm not in Brainerd, or I'm not in Bemidji or Duluth, but it's that 10-degree difference can make it all the difference in the world sometimes.
It certainly does for the golf season.
That's right.
We got 3 extra weeks on either end down here.
So I want to actually talk about From Field of Fairways, Classic Golf Clubs in Minnesota. This was published in 2012. A lot of great golf courses in Minnesota, and one of the oldest golf courses in the East Metro here is Keller Golf Course. Is that part of this book?
Oh, right. There's a whole chapter on Keller. Yeah, fascinating course.
It's being, and I was using that course quite a bit. It was actually a great value for someone with subpar golf skills myself to go on at the
Now, you can take subpar two ways in this conversation.
That's correct. Thank you. Everyone's a comedian here. it was including my golf game. But it's been renovating this whole last year, so I'm interested to see what that renovation looks like. They're renovating the clubhouse, and I remember someone telling me there that when they had to take a tree down, that there was balls that were 80 years old falling out of these tree branches. And they've had a little bit of water, and there's no antique valuable golf balls they can take to the pawn shop and get any money from, but there was 80 years of balls that fell out of those trees.
Well, there's been 80 years of bad golf played at Keller, but there's also been 80 years of fantastic golf played there. I mean, they started a PGA event at Keller the year after the course opened, mm-hmm. and the pros played there from 1930 until 1966. And during that time, they also played 2 PGA championships there. Sam Snead loved the place. He would play there every year. Probably the last big gathering of pros was in 1965 when both Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus played at the St. Paul Open. But it was won by Ray Floyd, another decent name. It was quite an all-star attraction for a number of years there.
That is amazing. There's a lot of smaller golf courses, I think, in St. Paul have been closed to development the last few years. I know there was Country View and Maple Hills from where I'm from are gone, and Keller is one of those remaining parts of the East Metro that is still around, and should be a really great course when they get some renovations done next year.
It was so almost surprising to me that Ramsey County came up with $12 million for the job. In this current environment where, as you rightly point out, we're losing golf courses. Parkview just closed last year. There's another one going down this year. Keller was obviously serving an important niche, but to expect the county to put that many millions of dollars into renovating the golf course, bringing it back up to standard, and a new clubhouse was really surprising. I'm more than happy that they did it. I know the architect. I work with the architect. We're putting out a book together on the 100th anniversary of Golden Valley Golf Club. Rich Mandel is an extremely talented designer, and he is going to. I've already seen what the course is going to look like next year. It's grassed in, and so that we're just going to wait for adequate development this spring, and should open up in June, I think. It'll be great. Golfers are going to love it, and I'm just so happy that the county decided to spring for it.
Yeah, we haven't. It's not been an economy in a long time where we've actually had spare change to be able to do the thrills in life. Mm-hmm. And I look, for example, Minneapolis Minneapolis came up with a number that it was going to cost about $30 million to renovate their city golf courses, Hiawatha, a couple of the others in
Worth.
Town. Yeah, Theodore Worth. I know at Hiawatha, and walking through the last couple of years have not been good for golf courses with the drought and the dryness, mm-hmm. and without having the
late springs,
not having the capital to work on the grounds, you're playing on sand for most of the holes. And there's going to be a lot of money to repair these.
Well, I don't know if you want to approach it and say we're going to put $30 million and do it all at the same time. Mm-hmm. It certainly makes more sense to me that you do them one at a time,
right.
Which has traditionally been the way St. Paul has upgraded their golf courses. Mm-hmm. They'll do they've done Phelan, and then they've gone to Como, and then they finally did Highland Park. Highland National, as it's called. And I think Minneapolis will do the same. One thing that cities have to keep in mind is that not everything that you do is for profit. Mm-hmm. There's skating rinks and ballparks that are not put there for the city to
make money on.
Right, yeah. You know, to be on the plus side of the ledger. You're giving your citizens amenities. You're making your community a more pleasant place to live. You know, golf is a sort of a higher ticket operation, obviously. But even so, you know, if you can keep your losses to something that's acceptable, you're making Minneapolis or St. Paul or, you know, whatever community you're talking about a much better place to live.
There's a question, and we'll move on from golf in a second here. We're wishful thinking because it's still a lot of ice on the ground. But do you think that golf is the younger generation, below Generation X, millennials, do you think that the golf sport of golf is taking them in? Because I look at golf course memberships, and I've looked at, you know, what the cost is, and considering the, you know, the cost of housing and just being able to live, and the fact that employment is so volatile now, are golf courses going to be able to maintain membership from the new generation going forward, do you think?
I'd like to be optimistic about it, and I know that golf still continues to appeal to certain young people who understand the you know, sort of the vast playing grounds that golf gives you, the open spaces, the particular unique challenge of getting your ball from point A to point B. But looking at the way golf has evolved over the last generation or so, it's hard to be optimistic that it's going to be able to sustain itself in the numbers that we were used to, that I was used to when I was a kid. My father, who played, it had a bigger part in people's leisure time back then, because I think there weren't as many other draws on mm-hmm. their leisure time. If you discovered golf, most people like it when they play it. It's fun to do. You realize it's going to take a little bit more of your time to get better at it. But if there aren't another dozen things that you could just as easily be doing with your time, you know, you'll devote that time to golf. Unfortunately, now I don't think we have a generation that sees it that way. I think, you know, there are going to be kids who still love the game and become really good at it. I mean, we're not lacking for good young players, mm-hmm. but clubs are lacking for young applicants to join clubs, and I hope it turns around, but I'm not seeing it right now.
And that's my question, because I've looked, again, as someone, you know, in with a, you know, couple full-time jobs here, looking, okay, so what to be the social aspect of a golf course, to bring guests on, to know people, the cost generally for a golf course membership is still out of even the realm of possibility right now. I think for a lot of people, like in my, you know, my age or even my peers, and I hope that down the road either incomes go up considerably or the golf course membership fees drop slightly. Well, to meet that spot somewhere.
Membership fees actually did drop. I would say 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, you all of a sudden saw a lot of the highest end clubs going from what they had hoped to get for an initiation fee and cutting that drastically. You know, you talk about a Spring Hill, for instance, that opened up sort of at the end of the golf boom around 2000. I think they were charging $120,000 to join at that point. Well, that's not happening anymore. Initiation fees are starting to creep up again since the drop in the middle of the last decade. But I don't think we're going to see them get to the crazy levels that they were at one point, because there just isn't enough demand for it.
Right. Our guest today is Rick Shefchik. He wrote a book called Classic Golf Clubs in Minnesota. I'm sorry, From Fields to Fairways, Classic Golf Clubs in Minnesota. Great book. And that's available anywhere, correct?
Sure. All the bookstores have it, or Amazon if you want to go that way.
Let's talk a little about your life. You grew up in Duluth. You went to Dartmouth and then decided to come back to Duluth to go work at the Duluth News Tribune.
Right.
That was 1978. So that was around during the Marjorie Congdon trial, correct?
Or was it? It was. The Congdon Mansion was three blocks away from my house. I used to go smelting down in the Congdon Creek, which ran basically through their property and right out into Lake Superior. My family knew some of the Congdon relatives, and we were allowed to use that area. I mean, I never was in the mansion until I took a tour of it, but you know, everybody knew who the Congdons were, and you know, they were part of the community where I grew up.
That had been probably at that point, and probably still is, the biggest scandal of that area.
It was the most talked about crime. It was a mystery. You know, that was kind of the interesting thing about it. It certainly was not open and shut about what happened. And even to this day, although we're pretty sure we know what happened, I think a lot of people are saying, well, I don't know if I buy that.
Marjorie's still on the loose. I think she's out of prison now. I think she's been to prison a couple times. I think she is out now. Could be.
I haven't been keeping track of Marjorie, but I think if she moved into my community, I'd want to know about
it. I think she's in Arizona. I think that she's probably not going to go to Miller Hill Mall anytime soon. But I think she's in Arizona. It's occasionally I used to like to see the Duluth stations would follow her very closely. I'd watch WDIO up in Duluth, mm-hmm. and they would have the Marjorie Condon update and what she was up to, because I think she was. That little arson thing she was in jail for a while, and then she got out, and it was, for us, the equivalent would be when, I can't remember her name, but the one that was in hiding for 30 years in Highland Park, and then she was in California. Sarah Jane Olson.
Sarah Jane, right.
Yeah, and that was a big deal here. When Marjorie gets out of prison, that's the big situation up in Duluth, and Duluth stations have the cameras out there waiting for her release to make sure she doesn't take a trip back to Duluth. But you came to the Pioneer Press, and you originally were a sports writer, correct? Before you
Actually, that was my last job at the Pioneer Press. I started out as a TV critic.
Okay.
TV radio.
And at tcmedianow.com, we actually have a lot of your former columns posted to our website, a lot of the ratings and mm-hmm. what the station personnel. Did you have an interest in doing media criticism, or was that something that was assigned to you?
Well, I was very interested in the subject, but I kind of fell into it because when I decided to go back to work for newspapers, I'd been an intern at the Duluth News Tribune for 2 years during college. I worked for the college newspaper, but I wasn't sure that's what I was going to do for a career. I wanted to be a writer. I knew that. Mm-hmm. But when I started working at the Duluth News Tribune full-time, it was as a copy editor. And there were no reporter openings, so I took that job, and it turned out to be a great learning experience, probably something that everybody should do before they start to move on to being a reporter or a writer. And once I did get an opening to write, I started doing reviews up there. I was reviewing music primarily, but then I would start writing. Then I was doing movie reviews and pretty much the whole art scene. And I frequently wrote about television. I've always loved television. I watch it a lot, and it was fun to write about what I was seeing. And the Pioneer Press called me up and said they had an opening for a TV critic, and would I come down and do that specifically? And I said, sure, I'd love to. So I did that for 8 years. But I got tired of doing it because it just kept becoming more and more of a gossip kind of a beat. And that's what I had never wanted to do. And
who's marrying who and who's got
pregnant.
Fired and why.
Yep.
Right. And, that position, and we've had a couple of your peers and predecessors and successors on the show here, you become a little bit isolated because the people you're trying to get information from might take exception to something you wrote at one point, and then you kind of become in a box there, and you find yourself. And this is not saying this is what was you, but this is what I've heard from past guests: is you get invited to less dinners because they think that what's going to get said at dinner is going to end up in a column in a week. And if you're going the gossip route, which was what you didn't want to do, that's how that spiral starts.
Yeah, people have to be careful talking about you. And one of my big regrets when I left the beat. I wrote a thank you column just to some people who had treated me well, and I didn't think about it the way I should have, but a couple of the people that I named were then suspected of being sources for me, which they weren't. I wouldn't have thanked somebody who gave me something that I wasn't supposed to know about, but still, that's how delicate the whole operation gets to be.
Sometimes there's no winning, is there?
I didn't win that one, that's for sure.
Try to give some gratitude, and it...
I gotta ask, did you find yourself actually not enjoying television as much anymore? Because a lot of people in your position go into something because they have a passion for it. They mm-hmm. really enjoy it. But then that passion becomes a job. It becomes work. You don't want to do it as much anymore. Is that what happened to you?
Well, I'm really glad you mentioned that because, as Tom said, I did end up being a sports writer my last 3 years. And I would say that I've had two passions in my life, sports and music. And you would think that I would have either wanted to be a music writer or a sports writer, but I didn't want to ruin my hobbies by doing them full time, so I specifically avoided being a sports writer. I did continue to do music reviews, and I never got tired of doing that. Television, I didn't get tired of watching it, mm-hmm. but where everything that you see on television is something that you may end up having to write about tomorrow, or making several phone calls to find out why this happened, or you know, why this person is here or why this person isn't here anymore. It's sort of like all of a sudden here's this box sitting in your living room, which is your job, no matter what's on.
Sounds like it would be very nerve-wracking, because if a phone call came in or something like that, you miss a second. Now everyone else who's doing TV reviews has something that you missed.
Well, I'll tell you what was really nerve-wracking is covering elections. I'm so happy I don't have to do that anymore. When, you know, we basically had, well, we had four channels that were doing news coverage, but there was no cable to speak of back mm-hmm. in the early 80s, so I didn't have to watch CNN or MSNBC or Fox. You know, we weren't basically trying to keep track of 8 or 10, but just watching the locals on an election night, I would have two televisions. I'd get the two TVs in my house right next to each other, and then I would have clickers in both hands, you know, bouncing back and forth to the four stations, and hoping that I was doing justice to what was being said at the time, when it was said, comparing to when another station said it, and hoping I didn't miss something, because obviously there's two channels that I couldn't be watching while I was watching the other two. So that was those were nights I never look forward to.
I'm picturing the Graceland with three TVs. You can watch, you know, three TVs in one
exactly,
time.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and you mentioned a good point. There was three or four channels of content to watch, and if you were reviewing something, then you were either telling someone, yep, watch this versus the other two shows, or don't watch this now. And I've talked to TV critics now. They're watching 50 channels. They're watching TV all the time, because not only they're watching now cable and satellite and regular TV, now Netflix and online companies now are creating their own original content. I was trying to get a Pioneer Press columnist to be on my show one day, and she said, I actually have to live tweet during American Idol. I actually can't step away, because we, as the paper, we have to be giving live updates on American Idol.
I'm sure you're talking about Amy.
That might be the person.
And I don't envy how the job has evolved, although she too sometimes has to do the gossip end, you know, mm-hmm. when a anchor leaves or a new reporter is hired or somebody gets fired, you know, she's on that, and you know, that's a necessary part of the beat. But yeah, the whole thing about live tweeting and watching some of these shows, the reality shows, you know, which we really didn't have at all. And you know, back then, a reality show was a newscast,
right?
So this is a new wrinkle, and yeah, I imagine that that's just sort of ratcheted the pressure up even a little bit higher.
So, I guess, Rick Shevchik, are you glad you left that business when you did? You're writing novels full time now. Mm-hmm. Do you miss it at all?
No.
Okay.
Never. Not for a day. As we talk about what other people in the business are still doing today, I just have this constant sense of relief that, you know, I'm going to be 62 in May, and I still feel like I could do it, but why would I want to?
Now, do you ever have young people say to you, hey, you know, I want to get into journalism. Do you tell them, go for it, or do you warn them, like, well, here's what you might want to know about the world right now? Because you were the paper for a very transitional period. You were there from, you know, the early 80s all the way mm-hmm. through the 2000s, when newspapers, they peaked at their circulation, but they were declining as far as revenue went and as far as what the content of the paper was.
Well, we were in what would sort of be looked at as a golden era back in the 80s and into the 90s. I mean, the Pioneer Press was winning Pulitzer Prizes, and we were, you know, able to take a lot of reporters and put them on big projects, and I did several of them for the paper. It was very exciting, but the whole time that I was there, we were always looking over our shoulder. We kept hearing, you know, circulation isn't quite as high as it should be, and you know, we're getting more pressure from the Star Tribune. They're moving into more and more of our territory, and who knows how much longer we're going to have two newspapers in this town. I mean, I was hearing that in the early 80s.
Well, in the 80s, no one got the Star Tribune on this side of town, and no one got the Pioneer Press on this side of town, mm-hmm. and that kind of flattened. And then this Tribune used to put out a St. Paul edition. That was kind of the big, I think the first gunshot they shot over the side of the river was they created a St. Paul edition of the Star Tribune in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, you know, Maplewood, where I'm from, we started seeing green boxes out on the street where people were getting the papers. And that is where I think that this was flattened out. The Pioneer Press, to their credit, they are still one of the few companies that actually offers all their news free online. If you go to their website, you read the stories, you don't have a limit of 10 stories. Star Tribune put a paywall. You can read a few stories and you have to pay for their content. Pioneer Press has not done that yet.
If they could figure out a way to make money out of it, they would. And they are actually are, as a subscriber, I know that they are moving in that direction. Mm. I don't even know if I should bring this up, but recently I noticed that my subscription price was quite a bit higher than it had been last year, and I found out that that was because I'm being charged more for my online access. And I said, you know, I'll get along without the online access. Just give me the newspaper.
Right,
and
right.
I said, I'm sorry, we can't do that. I couldn't strike a deal with them to just give me 7 days a week of the newspaper without paying extra to get online access to the paper. So they're finding ways of making money at it.
And have you had your subscription continuous for years?
Well, yeah. I have never not subscribed to the Pioneer Press since I started working there.
Right. I find that, not to give like consumer tips on the radio here, but between cable and these companies, if they think you're going to go away, they might strike a deal with you. They tend to find a last minute manager special for you.
Well, that's what happened. We ended up going into some negotiations, and the person I talked to on the phone talked to somebody else, and after a tense 10 minutes, we came up with a better deal.
See, and all due respect to my friends in the paper, I don't think we want to be losing any subscribers right now that are long term willing to still pay for journalism.
No, we still need eyeballs. That's
we do. And you know what we really do? We do need good journalism too. I think that one of the challenges we have, and we had a panel at Newspalooza a few weeks ago, and we had Stan and a few others talking about this. We had Brian Lambert on the panel. Mm-hmm. Is we still need someone to vet facts out. You know, actually produce a story that is actual news and not someone's opinion that is printed off onto the internet and someone picks it up and saying, oh, here's what I hear on the internet, this is what's happening. And it seems to be happening quite a bit.
Well, Ron Rosenbaum was talking about that as well. He was in the midst of helping out somebody, a poor anchor, who was delivering the news, but it was the wrong news. It hadn't been vetted out, and he was being sued, if I remember properly. Is that right, Tom?
I think that is how the story went.
Yeah, kind of important things.
Do you remember the story about the plane that came in too low in San Francisco, and you know, a couple of people were killed in that one, and then the phony names of the flight crew ended up being read on the air by an anchor in San Francisco because it came from a non-vetted internet source.
Fly too low.
There were some names on there. Then and you look at it. Now, not only did they read them, but someone actually typed them out on a graphic. And you think between, even if you don't vet the story, which you should do, but the person who read them, the person who typed in the graphic, you'd have thought by four people there. But there's such an urgency now because, you know, in the 80s, 90s, you had three newscasts, you had a paper, you had two editions in a morning and afternoon. We used to get two editions.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think if I remember properly in that situation, they spoke to the airline itself, but it was an intern at the airline. So, you know, how do you know that's an intern versus somebody who's working?
Well, in the old days, you would have made sure that you knew one way or the other. you're not going to assume that the person that you're talking to is not an intern. You're going to nail that down. Mm-hmm. But in the rush to be first, which, you know, I alluded to way back in the 80s when I'm covering elections, and I'm kind of the scorekeeper as the TV critic. I'm going to be saying in the paper the next morning, who called that state first? So we were part of the problem, actually. You know, when you're looking at the broadcast media in a competitive sense, they don't have a whole lot of ways to prove that they won unless the newspapers say that they won. And so I was kind of judging that and almost, you know, in a way creating a bigger problem than we had then.
And then you also, and to take a little shift here, you wrote a column, Go Ask Dad. For 11 years.
Right.
Was that had to be one of your favorite things to do?
Absolutely. I never enjoyed anything more than writing about that. And
how did that evolve? Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it evolved because Dave Winfield was working for our paper for a year or so. When he came back to town, there was a column called Ask Dave, and it was a weekly column where he would answer kids' questions, basically. Mm-hmm. And when he got, I don't recall if he was traded or if he played out his option and went to another team, but he was only here for a year or two.
Right. A big deal. He was here 1 year and then it was
But, of course, when he left town, you know, the column went away, but there was still that space. And I had written an occasional essay for our feature section about parenting issues because my kids were young and I was very fascinated with how parents came to make the decisions that they made. And when I saw that there was that weekly space was open, I pitched a weekly column to my editors, and they said, "Well, let's try it for a week or two, see how it goes." And you know, they liked it enough to keep it for 11 years.
Nationally syndicated column. This picked up by a few different papers.
Right.
The country.
When I decide every now and then, I think about a column that I wrote, and I don't have access to the Pioneer Press library anymore. But I'll Google a subject that I wrote about, and quite often it'll show up from another newspaper's website, Philadelphia or somewhere out west, something like that. So it actually made a lot of newspapers. I never knew exactly how many papers I was in, though.
Great column. Numerous awards, including the National Society of Newspaper Columnists, first place for humor in 1999, and the Minnesota Society Professional Journalist Page One Award. So the people enjoyed this. I enjoyed it, and I miss it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And those Page One Awards were kind of shocking to me. I really did not expect to win in that category.
This is a fun thing. This is like a fun thing that you did. And then
Fun, but you know, there were some really serious times where I felt like a parent's perspective might be interesting. I think there was a school shooting. I don't remember if it was Columbine, but I wrote about how parents need to sort of go forward with this with their kids and in schools. And, you know, a couple of times, that column and a few other ones ended up making the front page. You know, they weren't going to take one of my humorous columns and put it out there, but if it was a serious issue, they considered it journalism and gave it the proper play, and I appreciated that.
We've covered golf. We've covered books. We're going to talk about music after this break. Let's take a break, Tom, and we'll come back. I want to talk about your new book, and I also want to talk a little bit about Rather See You Dead. I think this is a very fascinating subject, and I want to talk more about your interest in Elvis and John Lennon. So we'll come back on Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB. Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osman with my guest, Rick Shepchik. Rick, we were talking off air, and we had this great conversation about all of your interests, and we never got to the answer on, someone comes to you and says, you know, I want to be a writer, I want to get into, you know, print journalism. What do you tell them now?
I try never to discourage anybody from doing what they really want to do. Mm-hmm. If somebody wants to take that a step farther and say, well, you know, what's your assessment of the industry these days, or where do you think it's going? You know, I'll try to be as honest and, you know, give as much insight as I can. But, you know, like I said, going back to the early 80s, we thought we were doomed. So, you know, you're going to be hearing that from people forever in this business. And, you know, I think if it's your passion, go for it. You'll figure out a way to make it work for you. And the industry is going to find a way to stay alive.
And do you watch House of Cards?
I never have, no.
Tom, what, House of Cards?
I actually am one of the few people in this world that doesn't have Netflix.
Okay, well, just a quick little thing. In House of Cards, a great storyline is the reporter that has all the inside sources from Kevin Spacey's character. She's a print journalist, and it's 2012, 2013, and the whole point is the newspaper has all the big scoops on what's going on. It's not a cable network. It's not a tweeter or a blogger. And she originally wanted to be a blogger, but she found a way to be a print, you know, a print columnist or print writer from this capital source, which is giving her all the great information. So it still can be done. You find the right source, you can get some good stories. Your book, Rather See You Dead, is a thriller about the contemporary repercussions of a possible meeting between Elvis Presley and John Lennon. Tell me a little bit about this. This is a very fascinating thing to me as a person who loves old rock and roll.
Yeah, I got this idea. You know, in a way, it was almost like a focus group. I sort of did a focus group with myself and thinking, well, you start out, what are you interested in? Well, I love to write about music, so let's do a book about music. I'd written three sports-related thrillers, and I wanted to do something different, a standalone novel. And then I started thinking, okay, if you're going to write about music, you know, who or whom would be the biggest names that you could get into a novel? And, of course, for my generation, it would be Elvis and it would be the Beatles. So I thought, okay, so what's the intersection of Elvis and the Beatles? And right away I started thinking about Germany, because the Beatles got their start in Hamburg in late 1960. It was their first time away from home. That's where they honed their craft. They went back there twice and came from basically being a thrown-together group that was a gleam in John Lennon's eye to the greatest rock band ever. And Germany really was the spot where it happened. And then Elvis, of course, served in Germany for 2 years in the United States Army, 1958 to spring of 1960. So knowing that Elvis was the inspiration for so much of what the Beatles wanted to be, I started thinking, well, what if their paths crossed? And so I did my research and found out that Elvis left Germany in, I think it was February or early March of 1960. And never went back. He never was in Europe again.
He never went. He never toured.
Never toured. Nope.
The colonel wouldn't let him because we didn't know if the colonel was had his passport.
That's exactly right. Right. The colonel couldn't go, so Elvis wasn't going to go.
He was busy selling Elvis's publishing rights.
Then I thought, okay, so when were the Beatles first there? And it turns out they didn't get there till August, so their paths didn't actually cross. But then that kind of got my imagination going anyway, and thinking that the Beatles really were—they didn't even have their drummer yet by early 1960. They were just thinking about calling themselves the Beatles in early 1960. So all of this is kicking around in Lennon's head. He loves Elvis Presley. Elvis Presley is in Germany, not that far away from England. So I thought, well, why wouldn't he even think about going across and meeting him while he's trying to form this band? So that's basically what I have as a setup for the book, is that Elvis is on leave. He went to Paris several times, and this is all documented. He would get a top floor suite at a hotel in Paris, and he'd have the chorus girls from the Lido come over and spend all night over there. So John Lennon meets a young woman who actually knows Elvis from Germany, she says, I can introduce you, and Elvis is going to be in Paris, and I'm going to be there with my parents. So I imagined a scene where Elvis and John meet. And believe me, that's one of the most fun things I've ever written in my life, is to write this scene where they're in a hotel suite in Paris, and John Lennon is meeting his idol, and yet he still wants to be the cocky, you can't intimidate me kind of guy, and Elvis is looking at him like he's basically a bug on the windshield.
And Elvis and the Beatles did meet eventually, correct? They did meet in the mid-60s when they're both at their... Well, I mean, Elvis was probably not at his height of fame, but the Beatles were at their height of fame.
Right. And in fact, this was almost the nadir for Elvis. 1965, he was making some crappy movie in Los Angeles. He'd rented a house in Bel Air. And Brian Epstein and the Colonel decide it's time for the two to meet because the Beatles are on their West Coast tour in 65. They just played Los Angeles. And so a meeting was arranged at Elvis's rented house, and apparently it was pretty awkward. They jammed for a little bit, but when they first arrived, the Beatles were just sort of staring at Elvis, and Elvis finally stands up and says, listen, if you guys don't want to talk, if you're just going to stare at me, I'm going to bed. And apparently after that, things loosened up a little bit, but that's the only time they actually met. But in my book, this is John Lennon's second encounter with Elvis.
And Rather See You Dead, that is e-published, so you can get that. Tell me how you can get that.
Well, you can get it on for any e-reader. You can get it for your Nook, your Kindle, your iPad. You can go to Amazon. You can go to Barnes & Noble, download it. It's $2.99. And believe me, it's a lot of fun. I've gotten great reviews on it. And if you like music and if you like mystery, because this all ends up as a contemporary mystery, it's spun forward into the present with a sort of a reality talent show, the kind that we see so many of on television today. But that relates back to this meeting of Elvis and John Lennon.
Rick Shepchick, the book is Rather See You Dead. I'm actually going to be looking at that. And Elvis and the Beatles, because I want to talk about this, I think this is a topic you like quite a bit. Elvis then kind of turned to the Beatles. He said these guys came to America, did drugs, and left. That's pretty much what he said, right?
He did. Back in his... I was going to say in the early 70s when he was pictured with Richard Nixon.
That's where I was going with this, because that's when he got Nixon gave him the honorary badge of...
Fine Young American Award, something like that. And Elvis offered to be a drug enforcement agent for Nixon. which was, of course, ironic because at that point Elvis had really begun his pill abusing. But I think that Elvis, in 65, when they met, Elvis was basically off the charts. He was not cool, and the Beatles were the biggest thing ever. And there's just no way that Elvis could not have felt jealousy about what had happened to his career. And it really was partly his fault because he let Colonel Tom Parker tell him that these are the movies you're going to make, these are the songs you're going to record. Elvis was a huge talent. He had no need for Colonel Tom Parker. If he had directed his own career, I think he would have been much better off.
Trusting and loyal to a fault.
Mm-hmm. He was.
And I made a little joke there before. You know, Colonel Tom Parker, he sold Elvis's publishing rights to his library at one point, I believe, for, you know, peanuts to what they were worth.
Essentially, I think, to cover Parker's gambling debts.
And to this day, and he never did tour Japan. I brought that up also because I think that Tom Parker was afraid Elvis would go to a country without him and realize, I don't need this guy to be managing my money. And you know, he had some very interesting characters that, not Elvis, but Tom Parker. I remember he was still being interviewed in contemporary interviews long after Elvis died, and he'd be on Nightline or he'd be discussing Elvis's death. A very, very interesting character in American music, and someone who there's probably a few books on him.
There are books on him. I read several when I was researching Rather See You Dead. And, you know, Parker was a flim-flam man. He wasn't even who he said he was. He's Dutch. His name is not Colonel Tom Parker. I couldn't pronounce what his real name is. It doesn't flow off the tongue. But
if you wear a bow tie, you know, a tie and a suit, you're a colonel. Come on.
Well, if you want to be.
Work for Colonel Sanders.
Yeah.
Do all of those books kind of end up with, you know, painting him as a horrible person, or do they try to stay as objective as possible? I'm not a big fan of the fellow myself. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. I'm just curious if they try to put a little spin on it as well.
Well, I don't know that there's that much. You know, he's not evil, but there's not a whole lot of redeeming. let's put it this way. We wouldn't know who he was if he hadn't glommed on to the career of the greatest individual musician of our lifetime and singer, I don't know. You know, maybe you could say Frank Sinatra or somebody else, but Elvis was as big as there was, and he was enormously talented, and Parker did him no favors whatsoever. So that's really why we even care about the guy.
So not quite as bad as Phil Spector, but...
Oh, no. I mean, you know, he wasn't a loon where... Right.
He didn't bring guns on the studio.
Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
John Lennon, one of the great stories of Phil Spector is, and he said, you know, if you want to shoot me, will you just shoot me? I need my ears to work here, Phil. Do you think the Beatles would have got that together had John Lennon lived? I think of the money on the table that would have been available, because when they broke up in the early 70s and then, you know, the 10 years after, there was not, you know, concerts were not generating the profits and money they were. I remember, you know, U2 with Metrodome here 15 years ago was $15 to go see U2. Mm-hmm. That'd be an $85 ticket today.
Right, but I don't think they ever would have got together for money. I think that it all depended on whether or not Lennon was in the mood to do something. And you remember that famous spoof where Saturday Night Live offered $500,
right,
the
right.
Beatles would show up at the studio, and they could split it any way they wanted. If they wanted to give Ringo less, that was fine with Lorne Michaels. actually, the Beatles were all in New York at that time, and they were on their way to the studio to do that because they just enjoyed the feeling of it. It wasn't going to be in Madison Square Garden, or it wasn't going to be in Shea Stadium. It was going to be in a little studio, and they could have a laugh about it and then go their separate ways again. And I'm sure something like that probably would have come up had Lennon lived long enough that he would have said, this will be fun, let's do it.
I mean, even for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, something would have happened where all four of them would be on, you know, be on stage. I mean, Simon and Garfunkel get back together. The Eagles get back together. Mm-hmm. You know, the Eagles have to go into separate doors. Whenever the Eagles go to perform at a venue, I read somewhere that all four of them, they actually have to go into separate entrances because they will not speak to one another. They go on stage, perform, and leave.
I just wonder if Yoko Ono would have caused that to never happen.
Well, I was going to bring this up because at this CBS special where Ringo and Paul performed again and all these other bands did their tributes to the Beatles, Yoko and Sean Lennon were right there in the front row dancing to Paul, grinning, smiling, having a great time. So if there were any hard feelings on Yoko's part, they don't exist anymore.
I think since the Beatles Circus du Soleil show, I think they're all friends now again. I think every decade, we can't tell if they're friends. You know, Paul and Yoko, they're getting along. I think they've had some, you know, every few years there's a disagreement they have whether they have the Lennon McCartney, McCartney Lennon songs, or are you selling your publishing rights to Michael Jackson? There's always a challenge in this business. Rick, we gotta have you on again because this is great stuff to talk about. We love classic rock here at KLBB, and want to hear more about your upcoming book on rock and roll music.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Rick. Tom, this is good for us. Flashback Twin Cities. We'll be back next Saturday here on KLBB Club 1220.